Prince's approach to the healthcare, education, and inclusion of transgender youth. Since then, queer activists and groups supporting the rights of 2S LGBTQIA folks have come together to challenge and speak out against policies like the ones proposed in Alberta, and have done their best to support queer and trans youth across the country. This week on Rabble Radio, Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Eleanor Wand sits down with Bennett Jensen, the director of legal at Egal Canada, to discuss what's at stake under the proposed legislation targeting trans youth in Alberta. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining me today on Rabble Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So to start off, could you tell me a little bit about Egal Canada and what your role is there?
Sure. So EGAL was started in the 80s by lawyers, and its focus was really to ensure that legal protections extended to, at that time, gay and lesbian people primarily. The charter had just been adopted in Canada, and so the first couple of decades of EGAL's existence were really focused on being involved in cases that extended protections to gay and lesbian people, and that all culminated in the recognition of the right to same-sex marriage, to marriage equality. After that point, the organization expanded its work to look at how the rights on the books in the court decisions could be better translated into reality on the ground in society. So things like workplace inclusion and education that recognizes all sorts of different people. We now do a lot of community-based research as well. And so there's all sorts of different areas beyond the legal arm that the organization focuses on. My role is director of legal, and my position was created just over 18 months ago out of a recognition that the threats facing our communities, so 2S LGBTQI folks, were of a kind that we hadn't seen in decades and would require greater recourse to the courts than we had in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, today we're going to be talking about this legislation that's been tabled in Alberta that will specifically impact young trans people in the province. The legislation sort of targets three areas: healthcare, education, and sports. So I was hoping to start with education. I mean, one bill that has been tabled would require children under the age of 16 to have parental consent if they want to change their name or their pronouns at school. It also requires parents to opt in for their children to be taught about sexual orientation or sexual and gender identity at school. And it restricts curriculum that teaches about gender diversity. So what are your concerns with this bill?
I think I'll take each part in turn, treat the pronouns part separately from the curriculum. Although my primary concern with both is really how stigmatizing this all is. When there are restrictions on access or information around queer and trans people, that communicates that there is something wrong with being queer or trans. And so fundamentally, that's the problem that I have with the bill. In terms of curriculum, we're really talking about stigmatization. So we at EGAL believe that all young people should be able to go to school in an environment where their realities and identities are accepted and, you know, acknowledged and celebrated, and everyone's sort of free to exist however they are. And that extends beyond gender identity and sexual orientation to religion, class, race, ability, all sorts of different areas. And when you try to erase identities from the curriculum, that's deeply harmful. It just denies people the ability to be seen. It limits the ability for other people to understand all the different ways that families can exist, that people can be in the world. And there's also really well-documented evidence about how much the lack of comprehensive sex education harms cis girls and increases rates of sexual violence, limits, you know, understandings of consent. So there are huge problems beyond the queer and trans community about the curriculum component. In terms of pronouns, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding around this one. I also am involved in the cases in Saskatchewan and New Brunswick that deal with restrictions on the use of pronouns in schools. And I think what people don't, I mean, I think there's a lot that people don't understand about this one in particular. So what we're really talking about is the ability to come out at their own pace and try on for size their identity in a lower stakes environment. So we're only ever talking about informal name and pronouns changes. We're not talking about anything legal or official on school records. And so for lots of people, queer people and trans people, the most high stakes conversation they're ever going to have, especially as a young person, is coming out to their family. And so we know that lots of students may want to talk to their friends or a trusted teacher and just explore, how do you think mom or dad are going to react to this? And they just want to be able to explore who they are in a lower stakes environment. So we're taking that ability away from young people. But more critically, we also know that there's a portion of the population, of the student population, for whom it will never be safe to come out at home. So unfortunately, not all parents are able to support having a trans kid. The majority of parents are. But there is this portion that won't ever be able to do that. And we know that the stakes for that population are really high because a single supportive adult can be the difference for a trans young person between making it from childhood to adulthood. And so the policies then deny that safety at school, that ability to be seen and validated and safe to be yourself. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about the pronoun piece. And I'll just add one additional detail. The legislation requires parental notification in addition to permission for all ages. So even 17, 16 and 17 year olds, there may be very good reasons as to why a parent being notified isn't safe. And the policy, the legislation rather, removes the discretion of teachers and school officials to use their professional judgment the way they always have and will result in harm. And in case you don't believe me, you can believe a judge. So in Saskatchewan, we were dealing with the same issues and we filed expert evidence to make the point that the policy would cause irreparable harm. And the judge in Saskatchewan agreed with us and found that a policy that requires parental consent for a student to change their pronouns would cause irreparable harm to gender diverse young people.
The Premier of Alberta has said that the Alberta Teaching Profession Commission has the ability to discipline teachers if they defy the government's direction in this regard. And you touched on something very interesting about teachers being able to use their professional discretion when it comes to this. I mean, are you concerned that the teachers could face discipline if they defy the government on this?
Yeah, and well, I think even more broadly across all three pieces of legislation, this is really shocking government overreach for a government that claims to be so committed to the freedom of its citizens. In each of the bills, the government is seeking to substitute itself for the expertise of whoever the, appropriate actor is. So in this case, the government is putting teachers in a situation of professional ethical conflict. Teachers and all people who work with young people have an obligation to act in the best interests of those young people. And teachers are going to be denied that ability. And so, yeah, I think there's a real concern about the ethical conflict that teachers will be put into. And the idea that a teacher could face professional discipline for being unwilling to cause harm to their students is really troubling.
You also talked a little bit about, the Saskatchewan government's decision, which is very similar to this, that would require, schools to obtain parental consents for students under the age of 16, before using their chosen name, gender identity, or gender expression. And they pushed this through with the notwithstanding clause. I wanted to get some of your thoughts on this. Are you concerned that we're going to increasingly see legislation like this pushed through by using this clause?
I hope not, but I certainly am concerned. I think that the idea that a government would knowingly and intentionally use the notwithstanding clause to limit the charter protections of children and youth, especially vulnerable children and youth was unfathomable to me. So yes, I have a real concern. And I think that once the notwithstanding clause is used, it becomes even more important that the public grapples with the ways in which its elected officials are using their power and stands up on behalf of the most vulnerable members of the community.
I mean, to just turn to the curriculum aspect of this, do you think part of the reason that there is, some people who are supportive of these measures in school is that there are some kind of misconceptions around what has been and what is being taught to children in schools with regards to sexual and gender identity?
Yeah, I mean, even the combination, yes, is my answer to that. And even the combination of sex ed with discussions of gender identity or sexual orientation is misleading because inclusive education that recognizes the existence of, same-sex parents or trans people isn't sexual in nature. And so I think that queer and trans communities have for generations, dealt with accusations or suggestions that their mere existence is somehow sexualizing, and that's not accurate. And then, but yeah, no, more fundamentally, like if you think just about the ways in which concepts of sexual orientation and gender identity are introduced in curriculum, it has always been very careful and intentional and age appropriate. So when you're thinking of younger kids, it may be as simple as recognizing that families exist in all sorts of forms. So some families are made up of a dad, a grandma, and kids. Some families have two moms. Some families are of mixed race. Some families have, friends as part of them. And so that's the manner in which these concepts are introduced to younger kids. So yeah, I think there has been just a lot of misinformation that is understandably concerning to parents. If you think that there is inappropriate content happening at school, you would be concerned about it.
I mean, I want to now turn to the healthcare aspect of this. Another bill that's been tabled would prohibit doctors from treating those under the age of 16 who are seeking gender-affirming care, treatments such as puberty blockers and hormone therapy. I mean, what are your thoughts on this bill?
Well, I'd even make one precision before that. The bill, as it's written, bans all gender-affirming care, so surgeries, hormones, and blockers for everyone under the age of 18. What we understand from the government is that by minister's order, they will create exceptions for 16 and 17-year-olds for blockers and hormones, and that they will grandfather in anyone currently receiving care. But the bill on itself is a straight ban for everyone under 18. I mean, to start with, I return to what I said about government overreach. This is an unprecedented assertion of a government in the relationship between a doctor and their patient, a doctor and parents. So it's the irony that the premier talks about defending the rights of parents and then is prohibiting parents to make fundamental decisions about the health care that their children are able to get. I mean, it's shocking and will result in deaths. And my language is dramatic, but it's intentional. What we've been doing since these measures were introduced or announced rather early in 2024 is getting to know the families of Alberta, particularly parents of gender diverse young people and the young people themselves. And the folks that I've met are very, very typical. The fact that the young person is trans is the least interesting thing about them. And they're well adjusted. They go through every, ups and downs the way all kids can and do. And yet the idea that they could be denied access to medical care makes them threaten suicide and quite consistently. So what we're talking about, just to paint a picture, because I think that again, here's a place where there's been a lot of misinformation. Let's take blockers for an example. So puberty blockers were developed in the 80s for cis kids who entered puberty at what was seen to be too young an age. So an idea called precocious, or a condition called precocious puberty. So blockers were developed to pause that onset of puberty until the child got a little bit older, where they'd be better able to handle the changes that come with puberty. So they've existed for decades. They're very safe. They have no permanent side effects. So as soon as you remove, stop taking the blockers, your puberty progresses the way that it otherwise would. So the idea that this is some sort of irreversible change is just false. What is irreversible, though, of course, are the changes that happen in puberty. So an example of the kind of young person we're talking about is a kid who was assigned male at birth at the age of 2 or 3, started making very clear to their family who they were, so identifying consistently as a girl. The families then, you know, went through their own journeys to eventually land in a supportive place and allowed their child to live as a girl. So that kid may now be, say, 12, 13. We have a decade of them having consistently and happily lived in their gender. And under Smith's policy, under the government's policy or the legislation, this girl would now have to go through male puberty. So have facial hair develop, have her voice drop, develop an Adam's apple, have broad shoulders, all sorts of physical changes until the age of 16, at which point much of the changes of puberty have already happened and are in fact irreversible, and then be left stuck in a body that doesn't match who they are, let alone the fact that a lot of these kids aren't known to be trans by their peers. So you have a little girl who all of a sudden has to be outed to her peers as the male puberty begins. It is cruel beyond imagination and will be devastating for the young people that we've gotten to know.
The last aspect of this, or the third bill, is regarding sports. And that would ban trans athletes from competing in leagues that are not co-ed and require schools and sports organizations to report any eligibility complaints. Smith has said that she wants to see sports leagues create mixed gender divisions to include all athletes. In your view, is this discriminatory?
Oh, well, it's very clearly discriminatory, like on its face.
Right.
But I think sports in particular is, you know, scare quotes, solution in search of a problem. So what we're talking about is probably a young person who wants to play on their school volleyball team or something to attend the one day tournament that you have in elementary school and won't be able to because of this policy. We don't know the details yet. And the reason I say policy is because the various entities are being, school boards, et cetera, are being instructed to develop policies under the legislation. So we don't know exactly how it's going to work, but there's no problem that needs solving. What we know about women's sports and sports in general is that for young people, the factor that influences the level of success that an athlete has is the resources given to that athlete. So what are the facilities that they're provided with? What are their coaching opportunities? What equipment do they have? You know, all of those things, not any physical differences between kids. So that's one thing. The interaction between these policies also, I think, is worth considering. So if a trans girl, so someone who was assigned male at birth but is a girl, has access to puberty blockers and then receives estrogen at the appropriate time based on the guidance of her doctor, she will have lower levels of testosterone than a cis girl, so a girl who was assigned female at birth. So there is no, even if you accept the idea that there is biological differences that should be considered, there isn't a basis for that. And Smith's policies will make this more of a problem than they would have been otherwise. But I think as with the curriculum issues, this extends far beyond trans young people. When you have gender being policed in sport, the people that suffer more are cis women who are viewed for whatever reason as not being sufficiently feminine enough. And that disproportionately affects racialized populations. It subjects all women, trans and cis women and girls, to policing about how they decide to show up in society. There is nothing being solved with this policy. There isn't a problem. There isn't an epidemic of unfairness in women's sports. There is real unfairness in women's sports in that it's chronically underfunded and opportunities for women and girls are so few compared to their male counterparts. There is no trans threat to sports. And so the solution in search of a problem and the harms that will result from this will extend far beyond trans people.
As we've sort of alluded to throughout this conversation, Egal Canada is taking legal action in response to these bills. Can you describe for me what that action is?
Yeah, so nothing has been filed yet because none of this has passed the legislature yet. And of course, that needs to happen before legal action can take place. But I think the simplest way to understand the intended legal action is that everything that we've talked about is a clear violation of the constitutional protections that exist in our country for trans young people. Each piece of legislation and each measure in the legislation is discriminatory on its face and will cause harm, which violates other constitutional protections, charter protections for gender diverse young people. So I continue to hope and have continued to hope that the government will reverse its intentions here. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case, but if required, we'll go to court, and that's what we're planning on doing.
And are you hopeful that, you know, going to court challenging this will stop this legislation from being enacted?
So I think the problem with the law, which is a funny thing for a lawyer to say, is that it's responsive largely. So yes, I think we have very strong legal cases, but I don't want to ignore the devastating harm that has flowed from just the announcements of these policy intentions earlier in the year. Society is shaped by the statements of leaders, and Premier Smith has created a permission structure for hate here, just like premiers of other provinces who have pursued similar policies have done. And it translates to realities on the ground. So there's nothing that a court case can do to change the societal costs that happen when hate comes from the highest office in the province. So I'm confident in our ability to have success in the courts. But I, as I said, I don't want to downplay the real cost of this, no matter what.
Before I let you go, do you have any sort of final thoughts to leave the audience with?
I'll try to leave on a slightly more hopeful note because it's a very hard time and everything I've said it's hard to hear. That said, I take solace and inspiration every day from the people that I have the privilege of working with in Alberta and around the country. The strength of these young people who are finding themselves targeted, the parents of these young people who are committed to ensuring that their kids can grow up in an environment that is safe and that they receive the message that who they are is fantastic and nothing to be ashamed of. Leaders and providers across professions that are so committed to the best interests of the young people that they work with. I think that trans people are known and loved in a way that they weren't even 5 or 10 years ago. And I hope that people take some solace in that. We're not going to disappear, and there will be another side of this. It just might be a hard fight for a little while.
Absolutely. I mean, thank you so much for joining me today on Rabble Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
That was our Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Eleanor Wand, in conversation with Bennett Jensen, the Director of Legal at Egal Canada. Thanks so much for that, Eleanor and Bennett. Listeners, to learn more about Egal Canada and the work they do, please visit egal.ca. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Canada is already feeling the consequences of Donald Trump's re-election as President of the United States. Earlier this week, President-elect Trump issued a threat against Canada and Mexico over social media. Trump is threatening both countries with a 25% tariff on all goods imported into the U.S., unless Canada and Mexico agree to Trump's border demands. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg explained that the U.S. president does have the power to unilaterally impose tariffs if they claim it is for national security reasons. In Trump's first term of office, he did impose tariffs against Canada, which were quickly dropped after opposition from the business community on both sides of the border. In economic news, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has announced a holiday on the federal sales tax on all groceries, alcohol, and other goods during this holiday season. Additionally, the Prime Minister pledged to provide all Canadians earning less than $150,000 a year with a one-time $250 tax rebate. While some applauded the intention of providing relief to working Canadians during this affordability crisis, the NDP, as well as labor leaders, say that it doesn't go far enough. The NDP would like to see the tax rebate program extended to seniors and students. While labor leaders like Canadian Labor Congress President Bea Brusk would like to see the government tackle the root causes of the affordability crisis, such as price gouging and rent hikes. And finally, staying in economic news, economist Jim Stanford explains the economic benefits of the Universal Early Childcare and Learning Benefit Program in an op-ed exclusively on Rabble. The benefit allows parents and children to access learning and child care that they may otherwise be unable to. Stanford explains that this provides economic benefits by allowing parents to work and setting children up for future success with a head start in education. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Do you want to hear Rabble Radio on your local community or campus radio? It's easy. To learn more, get in touch with us today at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
This is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, Follow us on Instagram at thepeak@sfu. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.